Fund versus Commonwealth. Mr. Katz, Mr. Powers, good morning, gentlemen. Have each of you signed in?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Powers, whenever you are ready, you may begin. Would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to reserve about 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
If I can do that. May it please the court, my name is McMillan Powers, and I represent Mr. Bund in this matter. Two charges, hit and run, and also a violation of the habitual offender statute. Facts are, as in almost all criminal cases, very important because we have to prove facts in order to convict people. In this particular case, Mr. Bunn was driving an SUV. He was also driving. Ms. Hicks was driving an SUV. She parks in front of her brother's house or her mother's house. It's not really clear, but she's visiting family. He hits the car. Everybody's out of the car except Ms. Hicks' daughter, Vernicia. He runs into the car on Carver Street and knocks the car about 15 feet, according to the testimony. The little girl in the car is 12 years of age, and she's screaming that she's injured. My client gets out of his car, remains on the scene, and this is one of the issues, obviously, in the hit and run, as to whether or not he actually remains on the scene. He has to do four things under the statute. He has to stop, has to remain there, has to park close by and not move away. He has to notify people of who he is, give some identification, and he has to render aid. Well, he does all those things. He stops immediately.
So tell us, let's take those in order.
All right.
Let's start with number one. How does he satisfy number one?
He stopped. He stopped immediately. Car's off. He gets out. He is there for at least 5 minutes. The testimony varies on that as to exactly how long he's there. He's there long enough for Ms. Hicks to come out and fuss at him, for the rest of the family to come out and fuss at him, for the people to begin, this is, of course, a legal fiction, but an attempted assault, which they're trying to get his keys. Which means they would have to have assaulted him at some point to get the keys. But nevertheless, they're trying to do that. He's there. Ms. Hicks' testimony is that he's there for 5 minutes. He then, when he's being confronted with these people, then he leaves. But he stops. He does not render any aid because the family has gathered around the little girl. There's no aid to be rendered by him. She is completely surrounded. They're going to take care of her or not. He provides the he parks right next to it. He moves the car out of the way because the testimony and
when you say right next to it, he was around a bend, wasn't he?
Well, he's right there in the middle of the street, and this is what.
But wasn't it a quarter of a mile away?
The attorney general said that his car was right where the other car was, and there was no reason for him to move the car. The testimony of Ms. Hicks was that the street could only allow for two cars in the street. If his car is in the street and the other car is parked, there is no room for any car to move. So he drives, he drives about 500 feet to his sister's house and parks. He then waits there for the police.
Isn't that where you then have a big problem? When the police arrive, he denies being in the accident.
And that's true. He denies being in the accident.
So how does that not convict him?
That's incriminating evidence.
How does that not convict him of hit and run? Because that flies in the face of every requirement of the statute about remaining, rendering assistance, giving your information to the necessary parties. He's left the scene and he's denied being in the accident.
When he's questioned by the police, initially he says, "It wasn't me." When the police say, "You look just like the guy they described to me," he then admits that he's done it.
Yeah, but statute, going back and admitting it after he's already committed
not,
the offense.
The statute does not require him to admit it. It just says he has to give the information. Now, I'm just telling you what the statute says. The statute doesn't say when he has to do it. Now, that's the gloss
but
that we
the
all
problem,
put on it.
The problem you've got is the offense is already completed by the time he gives the information. I'm sure that's what Mr. Katz will argue.
But the offense is not completed until he does not give the information.
It's but that's what denial is.
But he denies it and almost instantly changes his story and tells the truth. Now, that's certainly an incriminating
fact. You take an item out of a store without paying for it and then change your mind after you've left the store and go back and, I've had to change your heart. I didn't mean to take this.
You're gonna
the
have
offense
a hard time.
Is already completed.
You're going to have a hard time. And Mr. Bunn has a hard time. But he has basically satisfied all the elements of the offense as so far as doing what he had to do.
To whom did he give his information at the scene?
He gave his information to the police officer when the police officer
arrived. To whom
arrived.
At the scene did he give his information?
There's no testimony as to whether or not he gave information at the scene.
So the inference is that he did not.
There's just no evidence. The people knew who he was. They identified him as Mr. Gerard. They knew him. They knew who he was because he lived in the neighborhood.
But that's an affirmative duty on his part. It's not the duty of the victim in this matter to figure out who he is.
But they already knew. It's like if I
were... That does not absolve him of his statutory duty to provide his information, correct?
He has a statutory duty to give the information, correct.
Doesn't it provide a bit of a problem for you? Not only does he then drive down the street, as you said, to his sister's house, but doesn't the record show it's out of sight of the home and the location of where the accident occurred? It's not that far, 500 feet, but you can't really see it from there.
Let me just say that the sister watched the car go, walked down the street far enough to see exactly where he was, and she saw him confronted by the police officer. So he was never out of her vision. She went on down the street. Whether or not she was obligated to do that or not, but he was not out of sight. Now, that's whether or not he should have driven that far, it was only 500 feet.
I thought we had testimony that he was out of sight from the home and the location.
If you stood at the home, but she walked right, she followed him, because she knew that we're talking about a cul-de-sac. She knew he wasn't going to go very far.
You mean the grandmother followed him?
Yes, it was either the grandmother or Ms. Hicks.
Why is that then based on where she can see him from? Because she took it upon herself to follow him. Why isn't it based on where the accident occurred if he could be seen from that location?
I don't think the statute says there's a requirement for that, one way or the other. I don't think that's in the statute. Now, as a practical matter, whether or not that, certainly it's an incriminating piece of evidence and the court considers it. But as far as being a requirement of the statute, I don't think it's there. Now, as to the habitual offender aspect of it, the Commonwealth, and I think the brief pretty much covers what was going on here, but at the trial, the Commonwealth was relying on a case of Boone in which the habitual offender there gets convicted and the conviction is affirmed and his transcript is introduced, and the Commonwealth is saying, this proves that we can just present the evidence, we don't need to do other things, and the Confrontation Clause doesn't apply. The problem with that case is, in Boone, the transcript was admitted. In this case, it's not admitted. Then, going back a little bit further in Reed, this court was very clear that there's a requirement for the actual notice. And then 4 years later in Long, it recites language in a court order where we've got transcript, but also got a court order. And the court order says that Long is hereby declared to be an habitual offender, and his privilege to operate a motor vehicle in the Commonwealth of Virginia is hereby revoked. And they specifically cited that language in the order. That language appears in none of the conviction orders for Mr. Bunn. He is in no order declared an habitual offender, and he is in no order ordered not to drive. Now, he is sentenced under the habitual offender statute. This is why the transcript is the requirement of this court, and it's a requirement to prove beyond reasonable doubt that he was, in fact, an habitual offender and had notice of it. The cases then talk about he's in court, he pleads guilty, he has notice, he's there. But those are all cases in which he pled guilty to a couple of these, but you have cases there where you have the transcripts involved also. Here you have no transcript. He could have been ordered by the Division of Motor Vehicles not to drive. He could have been revoked by them. He could have gotten that letter. We don't know because that evidence is not here. When you then get to the recent case of Rose, and this is an unfortunate case, I think, for the Commonwealth, because Rose in the Court of Appeals, they like. In the Supreme Court, they don't like. because they reversed that conviction, and not only reversed it, but entered final judgment for Mr. Rose. This was a case where the court, the Commonwealth, was trying to prove his driving privilege had been revoked, not by DMV, but by orders. And those orders were insufficient. So if you take Rose and apply it to Long, to us, Mr. Bunn is trying to be convicted by the Commonwealth's attorney on the basis of court orders. But those court orders are under Long and under Rose insufficient. And if they're insufficient, he can't be convicted. All the Commonwealth had to do was get the DMV transcript into evidence. If they had done that...
You know, this is kind of interesting to me, because it seems to me your argument is the transcript is necessary. That's the only way you can prove what is in fact reflected in court orders, because the transcript is nothing other than a summary of court actions as reflected in their records. At one point, it seemed, I think the question was, you couldn't use a transcript because the best evidence, though it really wasn't a best evidence situation, would have been court orders. And it sounds to me your argument is now we've flipped it. We can't use court orders, which are really the substance and the base document on which the transcript is based. We can only use the secondary document.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with that analysis. Rose and Long, there is a court order that is introduced, and that court order says you are hereby revoked and you cannot drive. None of the orders introduced here, and that conviction is affirmed. He's done. Long is done. In this case, there are no court orders. There are five. There are none that say you are revoked and you cannot drive. When you put the two together and you have a transcript and a court order, if the court order is a little bit iffy and doesn't have all the proper language, the transcript kind of covers it up. But in a case where you don't have a transcript, the court orders, as it was in Rose, you tried to convict him in Rose by court orders and not by transcript, and the Supreme Court disagreed with this court in saying, no, if the court orders do not spell it out, that's not good enough.
What's
that's just where we are. And so I think that...
What is a transcript?
Say that.
What is a transcript?
A transcript is a document prepared by the Division of Motor Vehicles under the auspices of the commissioner, encapsulating and summarizing the driving record of any individual. And that is non-testimonial. It's not prepared for litigation.
What record does it refer to in determining that? You said it encapsulates his driving record. What documents does it use to define his record?
It would use the court orders.
So you are arguing that we should use a secondary document and not the primary document on which it's based.
No, I'm saying they should have introduced the transcript. They should have used that secondary document. That would have made it a lot easier. They did not. And
even
under Rose, at
five Stable, habitual offender convictions,
and not one of them, Your Honor, says you're a habitual offender and you're revoked.
Except that to be convicted under the habitual offender statute, you have to be a habitual offender.
Clearly, but under Long, that language, the court was very clear. You have to have that language, and it didn't happen. And then in Rose, just recently, the Supreme Court says, it's very technical. You have to have that language. And if you don't have the transcript and you just use the court orders have to be sufficient. They were not in this case. I would like to reserve the remainder of time.
Sir, thank you. Mr. Katz.
Morning. May it please the court. I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. Begin by discussing the hit-and-run statute, and respectfully, I understand Mr. Powers' argument. I would submit that what he's arguing is for a greater elasticity in the statute than the jurisprudence of the law would provide. Applying the appropriate standard of review at this juncture, viewing the facts in the record in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth, it is without argument that Mr. Bunn did not satisfy the requirements of the statute, did not provide his name, his information. He did not render assistance. The argument that counsel relies on brief is that he either had to flee the scene because he was in fear of being accosted, or he was simply moving his vehicle to a location in which it didn't block the road. And those are the hypotheses of innocence that he proffers on appeal. And I would, as I pointed out on brief, those hypotheses of innocence must rely on evidence in the record. And we have to view that evidence in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and the evidence simply doesn't support those hypotheses of innocence. As the victim's mother testified, when she exited her brother's home, the defendant's vehicle occupied the space that her car previously had on the curb, clearly not blocking the roadway. The trial court rejected the notion that he was simply going to the sister's house in an effort to come back and give his information. The trial court wasn't required to credit the testimony attributed to the defendant, "I'll be right back." It didn't have to accept that at face value, and it didn't, and it made sense. It was evidence in the record that supported that conclusion. So clearly, there is no hypothesis of innocence that can prevail under the facts in the record. I would submit he failed to meet his duty under the statute. Clearly, the conviction rests upon evidence in the record. It can't be said that no fact finder would have concluded as the trial court did in this case. Turning to the habitual offender, I think Rose is useful in that it sort of divides the issue into two questions. Did the defendant have notice of his status as an habitual offender? And is there evidence in the record that demonstrates the revocation was active at the time of the driving? And Rose specifically disclaims any question of notice. That's not an issue in Rose. And I think the prior convictions in this case to which the defendant pled guilty adequately establish his notice that he had been determined an habitual offender. So the only issue really before this court is, was there competent evidence to determine his status as a revoked driver was in effect at the time of the driving? And counsel's argument, taken to its logical conclusion, would say, well, you can only prove that one way. And I would submit that that's not correct as a matter of law. Clearly, the trial court could rely on circumstantial evidence that would draw the mind of a fact finder to an irresistible conclusion.
And I guess that's the big question in this, is was there enough in this record to not have to have somebody looking at it through our prism decide that it's almost been a burden shifting? We know that you were a habitual offender. You've made a couple of incriminating statements. You haven't told us that you've been restored or provided any evidence you've been restored, so you must still be a habitual offender.
And respectfully, Your Honor, I would modify that question slightly by saying I think the question for this court is, can it be said that no fact finder could conclude as the trial court did? And I would submit that conclusion was not plainly wrong, that you have the denial of driving. You have the fact that he doesn't present a valid operator's license, that it's an identification card. Those are powerful circumstances.
What about the don't call the police, don't call the police?
Certainly. In a vacuum, that alone might be attributable to the hit and run. But when you add that to all the other circumstances that the fact finder was presented, clearly it can't be said that no fact finder could reach that conclusion. I think that's the standard that this court must apply. I think viewing the evidence in its totality, it was reasonable to conclude that the revocation status was enduring at the time of the driving so as to support the conviction. I would ask the court to affirm both convictions. I'm happy to address any additional questions the panel may have.
Thank you.
I believe I have just a moment and a half here. In regard to the evidence of blocking the road, I don't want to beat a dead horse on the hit and run, but the transcript does not support the Attorney General's assertion that my client's car replaced the position of Ms. Hicks's SUV. It simply says her car was moved 15 feet, and when she came out, she could only see his car, not her car. It does not say where his car ended up. I just don't think the record supports that blanket of an assertion. As to the habitual offender, there are two ways, in fact, there are three ways the Commonwealth can prove their case. The simplest way is with the affidavit from the commissioner through a transcript. Otherwise, they can present court orders that are good court orders, that are thorough and complete. And thirdly, they can have circumstantial evidence, a combination of the two. In this case, they did not have any of those.
The offender's order shows that
he's been adjudged an habitual offender and shows it numerous times. Your argument is the order has to specifically say it's revoked in order for it to be what is required here.
Yes, I say that only because this court has said that and the Supreme Court has said that. Short of those announcements, I would be perhaps on board with the Attorney General. But this court and the Supreme Court have said the orders, if you do it by orders, has to have that language, revoked and you can't drive. And these orders did not have it, and there was no transcript. The habitual offender, I think, that conviction absolutely falls. And as in Rose, that should be reversed and judgment entered for my client on that case.
Thank you. Thank you.